Welcome to The Day I. This podcast is about stories of women starting. The moments they said, you know what? I'm going to do this. But this isn't another That Girl podcast. These are the stories of real moments that we don't celebrate, but should. Whether that's exercising for the first time, negotiating a salary, choosing to cut your hair off, having a business, a family, whatever it is, this podcast is about the days those stories started, so that you think, if she can do it, I can do it. Today's episode is for anyone who has had that feeling at a work event or a social gathering, and you have absolutely no idea how to introduce yourself. Or when you do, it's just quite awkward, a little bit cringe, and it doesn't really feel like you. The thing is that introductions are so powerful. They absolutely set the tone for how a conversation goes and how that person remembers you. And this episode is about capturing that, about learning how to introduce yourself in a way that that conversation goes exactly how you want it to. Sounds too good to be true, right? But the person sharing her story today is Anne Hyatt, former chief of staff at Google and Amazon. And she shares her story of owning her introductions, which she learned whilst engaging with some of the world's smartest and most powerful individuals. Hi, Anne. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on The Day I. I think the best place to start is a little bit about you and why you're here today.
My background is 20 odd years in tech, a career I'd never imagined for myself, probably largely because this career I've had didn't exist when I was young. It was very much a wave of the future. My very first job ever, actually, at 16 years old, 2 weeks after I got my driver's license, was working at a startup. It was only 5 people. They had been founded by 2 brothers who had just graduated from Harvard Business School. And startup wasn't even a coined term yet, I don't think, when I started there. But then my very first job after undergrad was working directly for Jeff Bezos in the earliest years of Amazon from 2002 to 2005. This was the Wild West of the internet. We had just experienced the dot-com crash. Amazon wasn't yet profitable, if you can imagine such a time. And we were in a single building, 15-story former hospital in downtown Seattle. And I knew every single employee by name. Now they have literally over 1 million. And then I moved to California originally to do a PhD at Berkeley, but was recruited out of my PhD and spent 12 years working at Google. A decade of that was as chief of staff to the CEO, Eric Schmidt. And then I left Google about 5 years ago and moved to Spain. And now I do consulting for CEOs literally all over the world who are experiencing the challenges around growth, especially around people and operational systems. That's what I do now.
Amazing. Well, I see no reason to delay you any further, and I leave you the floor to tell your story.
It's a moment of introduction, actually. It's a fairly mundane story, but when I was thinking about what has been like a pivotal moment of realization for me, this just kept coming back to mind. So I'd been working with Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, for probably 6 or 7 years at the point of this story, maybe 6 years. So that was about 10 years ago. And I was staffing him in Israel. He had a personal venture capital firm called Innovation Endeavors that was dual headquartered in Palo Alto, California, and in Tel Aviv, Israel. So we were in Israel to meet with some of his portfolio CEOs and to really get to know some up-and-coming, interesting entrepreneurs who were working on some of the world's most important problems. While we were there, so at this point, I'd been staffing Eric for a while. I mean, I've been, I think, 50, 60 countries with him, literally. And I was in Israel. It was kind of a multi-factored trip. We were meeting with government officials, which was a huge part of his responsibility as executive chairman, to educate lawmakers on emerging technologies and to build relationships. But we were also meeting with portfolio CEOs. We were just meeting with really smart people. We were doing what we called a listening tour because we were always on the lookout for what is the next emerging technology that's about to change the world. And at that time, 10 years ago, we started to think maybe it was this thing called artificial intelligence. Now everyone's talking about it over their dinner tables. ChatGPT is like all the rage. It's the fastest growing technology out there. But at the time, no one had heard of it. Only people in research institutes were talking about artificial intelligence. So I put together a dinner. Anytime we were in a new country, he would ask me to just assemble the smartest people in the world and have a single table conversation. So that's about 10 people. And I thought, okay, amazing. There's this incredible research institute based in Tel Aviv called the Weizmann Institute. And I gathered some of the most interesting academics in the world that were working there. And they were doing something really interesting and groundbreaking at the time, which was using artificial intelligence for health tech. For they had just done what is now famous of like being able to do AI-driven breast cancer detection, early stage detection, earlier stages than a human was able to detect it. So I gathered this group of incredible scientists. I was the one who chose them, got them invited to the table. I had their bios memorized. These were the most impressive people I could find. That's how you got invited to this table. Every single one of them had literally a Nobel Prize or equivalent. I mean, they were just the most staggeringly insightful, brilliant, interesting people I could find. So we sit down at this table, and it was hosted by this amazing woman. I wish I could remember the name of the museum. There's an incredible museum just outside of Tel Aviv that has private quarters, like a house kind of attached to it. And it was her home, so she was hosting us there. But we were surrounded by this incredible history, this rich history of Israel. And it was just a very, like, pinch me kind of moment. So we sit down and we go to start the dinner. Eric welcomes everyone and says, I'm really just grateful that you're here. I appreciate the work that you're doing and the changes you're making in the world and how you're making a better place. I think it'd be interesting for us to just, you know, 30 seconds, introduce ourselves. And he turns to me, I'm sitting at his right, and he's like, Anne, why don't you start? And I immediately like panic, because I was just like, that is the biggest waste of time at this conversation for me to introduce myself, because I knew the bios of the people sitting around the table. I felt so intimidated. And I really was just like, I think that my instant internal thought was, I'm not worthy of that. And then thankfully, I thought, okay, well, Eric told me to, so I'm going to do it. And I decided this is all happening there in a single moment in my head. But I'm thinking, like, why am I here at this table and what am I contributing? That's what I need to say right now. It's not necessarily the bio of, like, I can't compete with their bios. I think that was a really important moment, because if it was semi attainable for me to match what they were about to say, I probably would have tried to. But instead I thought, okay, who cares? I did, you know, a couple years of a PhD, I'm a PhD dropout, they have Nobel Prizes, like, whatever. But I said, I am Eric's lead contact at Google for emerging technologies and for identifying entrepreneurs around the world who are tackling the world's most important problems. And I'm here to identify this next generation of talent with him. That's actually what I was doing at the table. Was that my bio? Was that my official title at Google? Was that even, you know, the summary of the work that I did with Eric? No. But that was the role I was there to serve in that moment, in that room with the people. And it actually changed how everyone else responded. Everyone else then responded with why they accepted this invitation, why they were coming to this table, and what they hoped to contribute to the conversation, rather than going through their very, very impressive accolades. And that's something that's kind of changed everything for me since. So I, as you mentioned in our last catch-up call, it was really hard for me to remove myself or to reinvent myself from an identity where, for so much of my career, where I worked was almost my last name. I was Anne from Google or Anne from Amazon or Anne from single word Jeff Bezos or Anne from Eric Schmidt. Like, that was my entire identity. But then after this moment in Israel, which was one of the most fascinating and rich and transparent and vulnerable conversations I've ever had with, especially of academics at that level. Ever since then, when I have an opportunity to introduce myself, I use it with that lens of not how can I impress or, you know, keep pace with the other people around the table, which is always a losing battle, it feels like. But it's, I think about, what am I here to contribute? So for example, we went back to California after that Israel trip and we were hosting a board meeting. And by then the board members, you know, knew of me, were comfortable chit-chatting with me and stuff. And, but I started to frame conversations in a purposeful way like this. A board member would come in, I would hand her a packet supplement to the board binder she'd been sent in advance. And I would say, "Hey, it's great to see you again. I can't believe how quick this quarter's gone by. If you have any questions about this, the information I just handed to her, like this additional data, you can come to me for that." And that kind of changed everything because then they saw me, I framed for them how I wanted them to engage with me. I wasn't just there for logistics or for whatever small talk or niceties, or I wasn't just this, you know, I don't know. It just really changes the type of behaviors. Then when we would have a CEO come in for a meeting, I would say to him, "Oh, I saw that you were just at the Munich Security Conference. We were there last year and we observed X, Y, and Z. What were your takeaways this time?" And even though that wasn't about me, that gave him an indication of how to engage with me and the types of in-depth conversations we were able to have. It gave him an indication of my expertise. So anyway, those are just a couple of examples of ways that you can introduce yourself that invite people to engage with you in a very specific, purposeful way.
That's such an interesting takeaway. A little bit of a tangent to that. When you were building those tables, how were you finding who you thought were the best people? Because of course, there's people that are amazing on paper, but are not actually great people to be around. And how were you kind of navigating that?
I think it's very related, actually, to what I learned at that table. So we started this kind of unintentionally. We were doing, as I mentioned, a listening tour. That started when Eric transitioned from being a CEO to executive chairman. So he had never been a full-time executive chairman before. Google had never had one before. So we were really inventing his job description. What was the way in which we could use his expertise, his network, his influence, et cetera, for the best use of Google, but really it was of the people we were trying to serve. How can we show up in a way that's very meaningful to the users that we want to be helpful to, which is basically the entire world? And so we didn't know what the answer was. Like, what did Google and the users of our tech need? And so we started a listening tour. That's when we went to, I think literally like 42 of Google's global offices, and we just held town halls. He wasn't there to give a speech. He was there to listen. We did Ask Me Anything sessions where employees could ask, and they did ask really hard-hitting questions, not softballs. I mean, we had a lot of fun too. We had some silly moments, but they were there to really talk to top leadership about what we were doing, where we were investing, what we weren't doing and should be doing. And we were just gathering these data points. We wanted to see what were common threads across these conversations. So not only did we do that internally, we did it externally. And Eric is one of these people. One of the favorite things I've learned from him is he is insatiably curious, like really just, I'm talking like 1,000 more questions than a normal person would ask. And especially around areas outside of his expertise. Most people tend to kind of stick in their silos, their comfort zones of, you know, people in similar industries or levels to them. And Eric was always seeking out the new. So when we were doing this global tour, he would say, "Hey, I'd love to meet people, you know, who's interesting, you know, whether we're in Tokyo or Israel or Bangalore or wherever we were." And so at first I have a two-part answer to your question. So first I would go to my local experts because I don't know who's the most interesting person in Bangalore because I don't live there. So I would go to my experts, my network, and say, who is the most interesting, most fascinating person? Or I would say, who's working on something that you just think is wildly different than anyone else is talking about? And I would gather kind of these days. Then I'd research them and I'd watch videos or anything I could, you know, that the internet could provide me to give a sense of, you know, are they cool? Are they interesting? Are they, you know, I didn't want any like huge egos there who were there to flex or dominate the table or who were going to ask Eric for money. Like that's not what we were doing there. And then when I got the list, so it was always, we wanted to have a single conversation. So ideally I wanted about 10 people at the table. And normally, because it's Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, people say yes when I invite them to a dinner like that. It usually wasn't hard to fill the table. But then part two of my answer is something that happened by accident. And we had a last minute change in our schedules and we were going to, I think it was Beijing. We were going to be in Beijing and it was like 3 days notice. And he wanted to have one of these dinners when we got there. We were only going to be there for 2 days and I had 3 days to put together like the most impressive table of like incredibly insightful people in Beijing. And I couldn't, people just weren't available. They were like, I'm horrified. I can't believe I'm going to miss this opportunity, but I just can't make it in that short of notice. And I had five people confirmed. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to challenge each of these five people to bring the smartest, most interesting, most curious person they know to this dinner. And all five of them were like really excited because they wanted to impress Eric with this like fascinating, interesting person they brought. That changed everything. I always did that from then on because social scientists call them our strong ties and our weak ties in our social networks. Our strong ties are those who are from similar backgrounds, maybe similar region, country, mother language, university, expertise, etc. Those are your strong ties. Then your weak ties are somebody who has much fewer things in common with you. Think about maybe you're going to a sporting event and the person sitting next to you, they're a stranger. They might be from somewhere totally different country, different whatever, different language, religion, whatever it might be. But you have this unifying thing of this sports team that you're there to support. That's a weak tie. What I got was this incredible explosion of fascinating people through these weak tie connections that were much more interesting and surprising and unexpected, that added a new dimension to our conversations and, very importantly, to the observations we were there to make of how can we anticipate the needs of internet users of the future, came out of those weak ties. And so that has been just a best practice I stumbled backwards into by accident.
I guess the natural question to ask is, how do you introduce yourself now? Does it change depending on who you're speaking to and the value you want them to understand?
Yeah. I think my introductions are always pretty sincere, but they are tailored to the person and the time and place that I'm in. For example, last week, I spoke at 16 events during London Tech Week. It was exhausting. It was fantastic, but a lot. And that in those environments where, again, it's like the smartest, most interesting people working on really challenging, difficult problems in the world, it's easy to get intimidated regardless of what level you're at. Like you said, if you have one Nobel Prize and someone else has two, it doesn't go away. There isn't a particular level you get to where you no longer experience imposter syndrome. But I do try and tailor my introductions to the type of conversation I want to have. So I was at an amazing event sponsored. It was hosted by First Minute Capital, a really, really interesting VC firm supporting seed round, early stage founders in the UK. Just incredible group of people. Like they were, well, most of them are quite young. They're insanely smart. They're working on very, very ambitious things. But there was a woman there that I actually knew of because I follow her, I think, on Twitter. And she's a big supporter of an organization called Choose Love that raises awareness and supports displaced people during this current immigration crisis. And I knew from her posting that was something she supported, and something I feel very strongly about, is supporting displaced people and providing opportunities for better futures. And that's how I introduced myself to her. I just said, I really appreciate the support you're doing. I think this work is really important. And it wasn't related to what either of us were there to do, but that's the conversation I wanted to have with her because I thought it would help us connect around something that we were passionate about in a way. I didn't need anything from her. I wasn't looking to make an investment or a deal or ask her for anything. What I wanted from that engagement was for us to connect about something that felt very real. And, but then the next guy who was, I turn around and I start a new conversation at this cocktail event, and, he was a former Navy SEAL, and I'm a military brat. I grew up on Air Force. I was literally born on an Air Force base. So our conversations were different. Yeah. So while being very sincere, I'm always looking for first, how can we connect our purpose to each other? And then much more interesting conversations follow than, flexing in the beginning.
I think all of this is totally true, but what about the moments where you're kind of dealing with someone that has already projected onto you what they think of you? And the first thing you want to do is kind of show them that you're as big as you are, or you're worth their time, or you just kind of want to quash their ego because they've assumed something about you. How do you kind of think about that it's not always easy to step aside from your ego and step aside from someone else's ego and, have that kind of valuable conversation that you were just talking about?
I actually think you're bringing out a really important element that I would be upset with myself if we didn't talk about in this context. I do think that there is an additional burden, especially on women, to prove ourselves, because otherwise I can't tell you how many times people just assumed I was the token woman at the table or the pretty face assistant. They're like, they couldn't have dismissed me faster. That absolutely happened. Most of those people, Eric used me kind of as his canary to see how do people truly interact with me. Sometimes he would purposely be late to a meeting so that I would have that like 5 minutes with them to kind of gauge, like, and we had these secret symbols. I'd be like, you know, this guy's awesome or he's horrible. But like there's, it's, you tell a lot when somebody thinks like you're quote unquote just the assistant, which by the way, like smart people know that the assistants are the most powerful connection you could possibly have with any executive. But so that's one thing. I do think there is an additional burden. Like we as women do need to flex of like, no, you need to take me seriously. I am here. And that's why I think that single sentence of you can come to me for questions about X, Y, and Z is really important framing. Like the fact, letting them know you're the boss, like you own this event. Like I do think is important and additionally important for anyone who finds himself a minority in the room. So I had this observation after that moment in Israel. I was putting together, we hosted this event. So Eric went to World Economic Forum for 22 years in a row. It's one of the most prestigious, most important global events in the world. And he was beyond sick of it. After the 22nd year in a row going to Davos, Switzerland in the middle of January, he was just tired of having, as he put it, the same conversations with the same old white guys. And he said, let's reinvent this. Like, this is such a missed opportunity. There's so much talent. He's like, I want to host the next thing that's much more diverse, much more interesting, that actually leads to change. And so we started hosting a summer event where, again, I was gathering the world's most experts, most interesting people of every possible diversity of thought and experience and background and every definition of diversity you can think of. And they would submit their bios and I would put together a book and we would give that to them as they arrived at this event every July. And do you know, it was so interesting to me that I realized after doing that for a couple of years, the most interesting people had the shortest bios because they were like, they did not feel the need to impress you anymore. And those who were just, especially kind of like VP level, people who are like so just right on the cusp of like living their dream, they had like pages of their bios were just pages long, whereas other people would be a couple sentences. And I just, it was always, there was an inverse relationship. So it gave me permission, while I do think there's a burden, especially on women or anyone who's a minority in the room, to prove yourself and to teach people how to engage with you. I also think like all of us can relax a little bit and be a little bit more thoughtful of like, what am I actually going to contribute here? That's the most important thing. Like, yeah, there's some rooms, like when I go on stage, I have this bio, which I wrote myself, that every time is given on stage before I walk on, I'm like, oh my gosh, that sounds like someone else. It sounds like a different human because it sounds so polished and so perfect. And like everything went according to plan, which is not how my life or career went. But it's just the shiny bits. I had this youth advisor when I was about 15, who said to me, never compare your insides to someone else's outsides. And I just, that comes back to me, you know, these many, many decades later, of when I have that imposter syndrome moment, I'm like, inside, they're as messy as I am. You know, this outside polished, you know, story we tell about ourselves is just one element.
I think the big thing I've taken from this is it's about what you bring, not who you are.
That's the soundbite. That is the perfect summary of the ramblings I have just been doing. Like, that's exactly right. And you remind me of one of my favorite interviews. As the Obamas were leaving the White House, Oprah Winfrey was interviewing Michelle Obama, like literally days after they left the White House. And she asked her, how was it for you in the White House? Like, how did you were hosting some of the most powerful, wealthy, impactful, incredible people in the world every day. Like, how did you ever get comfortable sitting at those tables? And Michelle, without missing a beat, said, you realize pretty quickly they're actually not that smart. And she was, I think that's true. Not that they weren't important and she didn't give them the respect and the engagement and the partnership that that conversation deserved, but she didn't compare her insides to their outsides. They were actually just humans. And that's my experience as well. Like, I have been extremely privileged to regularly meet with A-list celebrities and heads of state and, you know, CEOs and billionaires and the people who are the top 10 of the wealthiest, most impactful people in the world every day. That was just the world I was in. I always felt like the dumbest person in the room. Not because I'm dumb, I'm not. But it was just easily so intimidating. And I would not have been able to do my job if I let that get to me. So while it all sounds very polished and like I had it all figured out, there were definitely times where I stumbled and like second-guessed myself and didn't contribute what Eric needed me to contribute in that room because I was intimidated. But yeah, I think Michelle's sentiment is right. Like, we're all just human. We're all just kind of making this up as we go. And no matter how glorified their bio sounds, there's a lot of messy middle that got them there.
My final question, and one that I actually really love, is there someone in your life right now that comes to mind that has been sitting on something and you just want them to go for it? And if so, what would you like to say to that person, knowing that the whole community here is behind them to just start?
So I have a sister who's 20 years younger than me. Same parents. She was a surprise. And so she easily could be my kid. I haven't been able to have children. So I kind of think of her as she's not only my sister, but like she's this next generation that I am really protective over and really excited about and want to support in my work now. That's really why I wrote my book, Bet on Yourself, was for her generation. I want to pay forward this incredible education I've been given through my career and my CEO mentors and pay it forward to the next generation who are going to invent the next future. So I think of her, not just her specifically, but her group a lot. And what I see from that generation is this incredible burden of this falsified perfection that we see through social media that makes them feel unworthy. They're looking for outside validation of their worth and their value. And that terrifies me. Like looking for that me really is a recipe for never truly being happy. So what I want from her or, you know, people now, this next, you know, the next Steve Jobs is in her dorm room right now inventing the future. And I can't wait to meet her, right? But she will not get there unless she truly has that self-validation first. And I think that's so related to what we've been talking about today. It's like, don't assume that someone else's credentials make you unworthy. Like their wins are not your losses, and find that validation inside first, and then look for a life partner, and then, you know, start your venture, and then ask for the venture money. But really what I want most is that, like, get that piece for yourself and don't look for that. That's not going to come from the outside. In my experience, it really doesn't. There's just way too many setbacks coming. But once that's secure, I mean, the sky's the limit for what you can do. And that's something that not many people have. And I've been working on this my entire life, and it ebbs and flows, right? Some days I'm like, I've got this. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, it's okay if you have those moments of doubt, but get that verification from yourself.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Day I. Whether you're on the tube, walking, at home, on the treadmill, cleaning, wherever you are, whatever you are doing, hopefully this was a story that you needed today, or a story that you can take something from. My two asks: one, if there is anyone in your life that needs to hear this, please send it to them. Because that is the whole point of this podcast, to get people to just start by hearing stories of others. Two, what is your day, your moment? Why not make today the day you... ...